You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. After a pro-Trump mob interrupted the process yesterday, Congress accepted the Electoral College tally that makes Joe Biden the president-elect. Coming up, we'll look at the fallout from yesterday's chaos and where we go from here. Now, Kenosha County District Attorney Michael Gravely announced earlier this week that the police officer who shot Jacob Blake in August will not face charges. Blake was shot 7 times and was partially paralyzed. Gravely said he didn't think he could prove that the officer, Rustin Shesky, wasn't acting in self-defense. The shooting sparked days of protests in Kenosha this summer over the use of police force against Black Americans. Blake's family members said they disagreed with this week's decision and are considering civil action in the near future. Filing charges against officers is rare. Our next guest has followed the issue for years and created one of the country's most comprehensive databases on officer-involved shootings and other arrests. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on the decision not to file charges in Jacob Blake's shooting? What questions do you have about officer-involved shootings in general? And when police are and are not charged with crimes, do you think we need changes in police accountability? If you work or have worked in law enforcement, what is your take? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Philip Stinson is a professor in the criminal justice program at Bowling Green State University and the author of the book Criminology Explains Police Violence. He is a former police officer and attorney. He created one of the country's most comprehensive data sets on police crime. Phil, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, Rob, it's good to be with you.
Well, on Tuesday, as I said, the Kenosha County DA announced he wouldn't pursue charges in the Jacob Blake shooting. Let's take a brief listen.
It is my decision now that I announce today before you that no Kenosha law enforcement officer in this case will be charged with any criminal offense based on the facts and the laws.
That was a little bit of a much longer presentation. Phil, first of all, in this specific case, what was your reaction to that decision?
Well, I had to really sit down and read the whole report that the district attorney prepared. It's a 40-some page report with another 40 or 50 pages of exhibits. And you get a really different sense of things of exactly what happened than I got when I originally had watched the video that was released many months ago, which was just horrific and horrifying to watch an officer shoot a man in the back at point blank range. Just horrifying. But when you look at all the facts that the officers had when they arrived on the scene that day in August, you know, things are a little bit different here. And I think we have to really look at the situation a lot closer as to why the decision was made not to charge the officers. In other words, a finding that the officers were legally justified or that the officer was legally justified in using deadly force.
Can you talk about what goes into a decision like that? And in some cases, it might not be the DA thinks this is the right decision to pull the trigger or not, but what could be proven in a court of law, what the validity of the self-defense defense might be. Talk about some of the factors that go into a charging decision.
Well, the district attorney's report goes into great detail on the law of self-defense in the state of Wisconsin. But as a general rule, a police officer is justified in using deadly force if the officer has a reasonable apprehension of an imminent threat of serious bodily injury or death being imposed against the officer or someone else. And the U.S. Supreme Court has clarified that that's a standard of objective reasonableness. It's, in other words, it's what a reasonable police officer in that situation without the benefit of hindsight would have perceived at that instant when the shooting took place as to whether it was justified or not. So if an officer's subjective belief is objectively unreasonable, then that officer would not be legally justified in using deadly force. So what we have here is a situation where quite simply, you know, it's the district attorney's position that a reasonable police officer could have or would have perceived such a threat in that instance. And it's very fact specific. It's because of the facts of this case that are detailed in the district attorney's report as to why the district attorney drew that conclusion. Now, as to your question as to the charging decision and things that go into it, oftentimes prosecutors look at, you know, the likelihood of getting a conviction. In fact, there's an ethical rule that deals with that. They obviously have to have probable cause to bring charges, but they also have to have a good faith belief a reasonable belief that they could obtain a conviction. So they have a downward look here to decide, is this something they want to go forward with? And frankly, some of these cases are very difficult. And in some instances, prosecutors have made the decision to go forward and bring charges, saying at the time they bring charges, we know this is going to be difficult to do, but our job as a prosecutor is to seek justice, and we're going to let the jury be the trier of fact, and we'll have a trial. And that's not what happened in this situation, though.
How often in officer-involved shootings do charges end up being filed? And when charges are filed, how often does that result in a conviction?
Well, we really don't have a whole lot of data in this area. And in terms of the number of on-duty shootings across the country where an officer shoots and kills someone each year, the best data we have is only from 2015, and that's data from the Washington Post. And we now know that on average, about 1,000 times each year, on-duty police officers shoot and kill someone. And I can tell you from my own research, since 2005, only 127 officers across the country, so non-federal sworn law enforcement officers, so that would be police officers, sheriff's deputies, state troopers, game wardens, only 127 officers have been charged since 2005. And to date, I think only 44 of those officers have been convicted. So about 30 of the cases are still pending, and I think 54 of the officers or so, or 52 of the officers, their cases ended in a non-conviction, and that could be for a variety of reasons. So out of 1,000 times each year, we saw 15 officers who were charged last year in 2020. The year before that, we only saw 12 officers. And then as I look back in my data since 2005, we actually see the number of officers charged. It's actually anywhere from just one officer charged, which was in 2011, to a high of 18 officers charged in 2015. So in every year, it's been fewer than 20 officers charged with murder or manslaughter resulting from an on-duty shooting across the country since 2005. And the reason for that is because in most instances of on-duty fatal shootings by sworn law enforcement officers, there's a determination made that the officer was legally justified in using deadly force.
We're talking to Philip Stinson from Bowling Green State University, author of the book Criminology Explains Police Violence, looking at the decision in Kenosha to not charge the officer and the officers involved in the shooting of Jacob Blake, and wider issues of police accountability when officers are and aren't charged. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Mark is with us in La Crosse. Mark, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, yes, Mark?
I wanted to first say my hat is off to all law enforcement out there across this great nation. I think that they face a lot of stressful situations that most people don't want to be in to begin with. When they're walking into a domestic dispute or to a drunk driving thing or to whatever it is, responding to a call, and they're going into a hot zone. And their lives are at stake. They want to go home at night, see their loved ones and everything like that, just like everybody else does. And I think as a society, we have lost respect for law enforcement individuals. If you are a law-abiding citizen in this country to begin with, and you are not doing something wrong, and a police officer stops you or talks to you, and the first thing your reaction is to do is run or get aggressive or get verbally abusive or anything like that, that is intolerable in this country. Police officers are there to protect and serve, the vast majority of them, and to do their jobs honorably. And if they have to use lethal force, I'm all in for, if an officer tells you to stop, put your hands in the air and drop whatever is in your hands, and you do not do that, and they can't identify what is in your hands, to me, that now becomes, whether it's a rock or a glass bottle.
I think we got you, Mark. I want to bring Phil in on this now. Mark, expressing, I think, a commonly held point of view. What do you think, Phil?
I think that's true, and Mark raises some good points. I think that, I come at this with, sitting here as a 56-year-old white male professor, you know, with tenure at a state university in Ohio. So many people have different experiences, though. I talk to people all across the country on a regular basis, you know, many Black individuals who share with me stories of very different experiences with law enforcement officers than the ones that I've had. And I think that we have to be cognizant of that, that there are people of all walks of life who have very different experiences and encounters with law enforcement officers. But his points are well taken.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Phil Stinson right now, professor in the criminal justice program at Bowling Green State University, looking at why police officers seldom face charges for fatal shootings, coming after the Kenosha County District Attorney said he would not be filing charges in the August shooting of Jacob Blake. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reaction to that decision. Your questions about police accountability in general, our guest knows a lot about the topic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation, take more of your calls coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Phil Stinson, professor of criminal justice at Bowling Green State University, looking at when police officers can be charged in fatal shootings, coming after this week's decision in Kenosha to not charge officers involved in the shooting of Jacob Blake. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. James is with us in Milwaukee. James, hi.
How are you? I'd like to say that I think I have a way to stop all these shootings overnight, and that's insurance bonds. Every police officer in the country should be covered by insurance bonds. Now, most people have never heard of insurance bonds, and I'll take a moment to explain it. Let's take your car insurance. You have car insurance. You pay it on a monthly basis. You have an accident. You make a claim. Well, on an insurance bond for a police officer, there should never be a claim, because once a claim is made, that police officer is on the hook, and that police officer cannot do anything unless that bond is paid. So I think that would stop it overnight.
James, thanks for the call. I've seen this idea floated, Phil. I'm not sure exactly how it would work or if it would work. Do you have thoughts on that idea?
Actually, I've not heard of the issue of insurance bonds, as James mentioned in that context. But, you know, a related matter is the doctrine of qualified immunity. And that comes into play when officers are named as defendants in federal civil rights lawsuits. And the idea behind qualified immunity is that officers are immune from money judgments if the court holds a qualified immunity in place for a case. But I'm not sure that getting rid of qualified immunity is going to solve a whole lot because, and by the way, in my research, we've discovered that the police officers are sued far more often than you might imagine across the country in federal courts and in local courts as well. But many police officers, quite frankly, are judgment proof, and that, civil defense attorneys are interested if they're suing for money damages, they're interested in the deep pockets of the municipality or their insurance carriers. So, James, you raise a good point, though, with insurance bonds. That's something I'd need to take a closer look at.
Thanks for the call. We've got a Cindy with us now in Appleton. Cindy, hello.
Hello. Well, you know, I wouldn't have such a problem with these kind of issues, except that it seemed to be predominantly happening to Black people. And you had that 17-year-old in Kenosha that shot two people during those riots, walking up and down the street with a lethal weapon, which he had actually discharged, and nobody even said boo to him. So I don't know how somebody like your last caller can think that, not the last caller, but a couple callers ago, that it, you know, it's all right to just shoot somebody if they look like they're not, you know, doing something right. And here you have this young man walking up and down the street. He shouldn't even have a gun, and he gets nothing. So my problem with this is it's predominantly the Black people that happens to.
Cindy, thanks for the call. What do we know about the racial makeup, Phil, of people who are shot by police officers?
Well, we really still don't have enough data that we can actually really answer that question in a quantitative way. But I can tell you from my own research, it does seem that many police officers have a fear of Black people, and specifically Black men and boys. And by the way, when we look at the cases where officers are arrested and charged with murder or manslaughter for having shot a Black woman, Every one of those cases, the woman was shot at her own home, which really is an interesting issue. But I think we have to deal with, you know, that you can't deal with anything in the criminal justice system without looking at race and racism. And we frame it in the context of institutional racism. And I just like to get it out there that it's at even a more base level. It's that there's a fear of Black people that is pronounced in many of the more than 18,000 state and local law enforcement agencies across the country. And I don't know that we can fix this with a few hours of implicit bias training. We have to really hit this issue head on. And I don't know how we do that. But the first step is recognizing that it's a problem.
Thanks for that call. You've mentioned a couple times, and I've heard this from other people who work in criminology, that we don't have great data on police shootings. We collect a lot of data in this country. Why do we have this sort of blind spot?
Well, I think it's because historically it's not been something that the U.S. Department of Justice has been interested in. It's not been something that they've cared to take a look at. It's only been a handful of criminologists and journalists, frankly, across the country who've taken a very close look at it. And it's very difficult to track data. So, you know, I study police crime. So I study cases where police officers are arrested for crimes. And I've done that, as I said earlier, since 2005. And much of my data is publicly available in a searchable database. It's called the Henry A. Wallace Police Crime Database. And you can find it on the internet at policecrime.bgsu.edu. And the reason I got into that research as a graduate student, I'd been a police officer, I'd been an attorney, and I went back to school and was a graduate student. And I realized about 16, 17 years ago that the government simply did not track instances where officers were charged with crimes for anything. And they certainly didn't track any data at that time that was very useful on police shootings. So it's something that in recent years, the Justice Department has tried to get a handle on. They've started more data collection, but it's voluntary at these more than 18,000 state and local law enforcement agencies. And we'll see how they do in this latest round.
We are talking to Phil Stinson from Bowling Green State University in Ohio. He is a criminal justice professor there, former police officer and attorney, looking at when police get charged for crimes, when they're charged for fatal shootings. Back to your calls. Steve is with us in Madison. Steve, hi.
Oh, hi. Yes, I'm not buying the shooting in the back of somebody is okay ever. I mean, where's the taser? And apparently if the taser was ineffective, well, that must have been a bad shot. Sorry, that's on them. This is all on the police. Get it straight. The police are accountable for this.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Steve, referring to the Jacob Blake case where a taser, I think, was used twice before the shooting there. But Phil, Steve making the case that police in this case and maybe others, he thinks too quick to resort to lethal force.
No, Steve raises a good point. You know, when I was a young police officer about 35 years ago now, you know, it was right after the Supreme Court issued its opinion in Tennessee versus Garner. And I thought at that time, as a 21-year-old police officer, that that was the last time that a Black adolescent male was going to be shot in the back by a police officer in this country. And we now know that it happens frightfully often, quite frankly. And I share Steve's concern. And that's why I was concerned with the initial video. But there are a lot more facts here. But you do wonder if officers could simply have tackled him and disarmed him with the knife that Mr. Blake had and kept him from getting in the car. But I don't want to second guess the actions of the officers. But I am with Steve that it's very troubling when we see Black males shot in the back by police officers. It frankly shouldn't be happening.
Thanks for the call. Phil, have you compared and contrasted U.S. Police behavior with that in other comparable countries around the world? How do we stack up? Are there lessons to be learned?
Well, I don't know that we have good data in this area either in terms of a comparative analysis, and I haven't looked at that closely, but I assume that we have far more shootings in this country than in many comparable developed countries around the world, but we just don't have good data on that.
Let's bring on another caller. Patrick is with us now in Milwaukee. Patrick, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'd like to respond to some of the comments that the first caller made, which was a very tired notion that somehow if people just responded to police respectfully and submissively, that then they wouldn't get shot. That if they're not breaking the law, they wouldn't put themselves in a position to be shot and killed. And this is just untenable. If you look at a case like, say, Breonna Taylor's, she was in bed sleeping, and there's dispute, of course, whether or not the police identified themselves, but neither she nor her boyfriend had been convicted of any crimes at this point. She wasn't doing anything illegal, and yet she died because of police excessive force. I have to put that out in counterpoint. My question for the guest is about your research, because the first caller's idea that, you know, obeying the law keeps you from getting shot is on the face of it silly, but it also ignores research like yours, which might point out, because it doesn't explain.
Okay, Patrick, we just have a few moments left. No time for your question, but Phil, do you want to respond to Patrick's first point there?
Well, I think Patrick is right. I mean, you know, we have a problem in the past that the police have always owned the narrative in these situations, and bystanders' accounts have not been taken seriously. And what we've seen with technology, with bystanders, with citizens having a smartphone video recording capability, with body cameras, with dash cams, with security cams, that we're starting to get alternative narratives. And in instances where the factual narratives of the police are inconsistent with the video evidence, that's very helpful to prosecutors in trying to figure out what happened in these situations and whether charges are appropriate.
Phil, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
That's Philip Stinson, professor in the criminal justice program at Bowling Green. His research tracks data on officer-involved shootings as well as criminal charges against police officers. He joined us for a look at the decision not to charge a Kenosha police officer in the shooting of Jacob Blake and why criminal charges in officer-involved shootings are uncommon. Coming up, we'll get the latest on what's happening in Washington, D.C. after yesterday's mob activity at the nation's capital. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Tonight at 6, it's a special edition of On Point with the latest on the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. You could share your thoughts right now. Leave On Point a message. You can call in at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Call in with your reaction, then join On Point tonight at 6 on the Ideas Network. Now, a day after a pro-Trump mob stormed the Capitol as Congress was counting the electoral ballots to confirm President-elect Joe Biden's victory, many Democrats are calling for President Trump to be removed from office. In a statement, Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer said the violence was incited by Trump. His comments were echoed by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
I join the Senate Democratic leader in calling on the Vice President to remove this president by immediately invoking the 25th Amendment. If the Vice President and the Cabinet do not act, the Congress may be prepared to move forward with impeachment.
Meanwhile, Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao says she will resign from her post a couple of weeks ahead of schedule. Former White House Chief of Staff and Special Envoy now to Northern Ireland, Mick Mulvaney, said he was stepping down, as did some other administration staffers. After Congress ultimately certified Biden's win, Trump pledged an orderly transfer of power on January 20th, Inauguration Day. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see happen next? How much responsibility do you see the president having for what happened yesterday? Do you want to see him removed from office or impeached before Inauguration Day? If you supported Trump, are you still with him today? Are you concerned about the final 2 weeks of the Trump presidency? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Susan Johnson is an associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. Susan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Susan, big picture, your reaction to what we saw yesterday.
Wow, it was sad. It was appalling, shocking. I mean, it was all kinds of things. I think that most people who were watching it unfold had a, I would think, would have a combination of those kinds of emotions. I mean, seeing the destruction at the Capitol, you know, was just was heartbreaking in many ways. And just the idea of the disrespect that was being shown for the Capitol was, you know, appalling. And then I think, you know, people were genuinely afraid. The more accounts that I read after the fact of people who were involved, it was a scary, scary situation.
And now we just heard the House Speaker. She was joining the Senate, currently minority leader, in calling for the president to be removed via the 25th Amendment. We've seen a couple of Republicans in the House echo those calls. One of the president's former chiefs of staff said, Jim Kelly said if he was on the cabinet, he would vote to remove the president via the 25th Amendment. Can you talk about that mechanism for the removal of a president? Easier said than done in many ways.
Sure. I'm guessing that the 25th Amendment is one of the most frequently Googled items today, if we looked at the analytics. The 25th Amendment was first came up as an idea during the Eisenhower administration by President Eisenhower, looking at issues of presidential succession, particularly in cases of presidential incapacitation. It didn't get passed and ratified until after President Kennedy was assassinated. But there's four parts to it. The relevant part when people talk now about invoking the 25th Amendment is Section 4, which has never been invoked. And that is when the vice president and a majority of the cabinet can move to remove the president from office due to certain incapacitation. And so that's what Minority Leader Schumer and Speaker Pelosi and a small number of Republicans, many Democrats, are calling on Vice President Pence to do with the cabinet at this point.
Now, we're seeing reaction from some Republicans, maybe not going quite that far, but longtime allies, including Lindsey Graham, Senator from South Carolina, distancing themselves from the president in his last days in office. I want to give a listen to Senator Graham. He, as he voted to certify the election against some of the, a couple of the state challenges. Here's a listen to Lindsey Graham late last night.
Trump and I, we've had a hell of a journey. I hate it being this way. Oh my God, I hate it. From my point of view, he's been a consequential president. But today, first thing you'll see, all I can say is count me out. Enough is enough. I've tried to be helpful.
And we see our own Corinne Hess reports the longtime Republican mayor of Waukesha, Sean Riley, put this on Facebook, quoting, "This will possibly be the cause of the end of my political career, but I have to put this out because I'm so upset. I am ashamed that I was a member of the Republican Party, and I do not know how I can ever be a member again." Susan, the reaction from Republicans to the last day's events, what do you make of it? A wide range of reaction.
It's very much a wide range of reactions. And there have been other Republicans who have come forward very, very strongly in their condemnation of the actions, including members of the Wisconsin congressional delegation and members of other political leaders in Wisconsin. And there have been some, I would say someone like Adam Kinzinger, who is a Republican member of Congress from Illinois. He's been a vocal Trump critic, and of the Republicans' office holders in Congress, for example, that I've heard, his has been the strongest statements that have come out as far as actually invoking the 25th Amendment. And there have been a few way to the other end who have, you know, not come out and done anything or I read very recently that Steve Scalise, who is the one of the top-ranking members in the House Republican leadership, was, even as of yesterday, speaking perhaps that it wasn't Trump supporters who did this in the Capitol. So, I mean, there's a range of reactions, but for the most part, I would say the majority of Republicans have come out very strongly against the violence, without a doubt. It's whether or not they're blaming the president or asking the president to hold himself responsible for inciting the mob action at the Capitol, which is where we see a lot of different distinctions.
I wanted to bring up that issue of the misinformation out there. I mean, misinformation is a lot of what led up to yesterday. False claims about what the vice president could do. False claims, of course, about the outcome of the election itself. And within minutes or hours, we had the claims of effectively a false flag operation here. Some on the floor of Congress said this. Echoed by a lot of media outlets of dubious provenance. Some stories have come out and then been debunked quickly. The people that are being identified as being in the Capitol are longtime bloggers or YouTubers or whatever with white nationalist affiliations, QAnon, whatever they are, affiliations. But the misinformation spreads so quickly, Susan, within a day of this event. How damaging is this?
It's very damaging, and it just speaks to perpetuate a lot of these problems. And I was going to use the same example that you just gave in your when you were asking me the question. Many of the people whose pictures we have seen all over the internet and all over television are people that are very well known in the pro-Trump circles. There are also people who were in the Capitol who are elected Republican officials. There's a Republican elected from the West Virginia state legislature who was live tweeting or live Facebooking his entry into the Capitol. So, I mean, I think it's ridiculous, frankly, to suggest that these were anything but very hardcore supporters of the president and not Antifa or any of the other groups that they're now coming out and suggesting might have been involved.
Talking to Susan Johnson from UW-Whitewater, looking at yesterday's events at the Capitol and what comes next. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Shelley is with us in Madison. Shelley, hi.
Hi, thank you. My question is about if indeed Trump continues to be in power for even 13 days, what are the risks of leaks of sensitive information to people who are not allies of the United States?
Shelley, thanks for the call. Shelley, worried about President Trump and guarding national security information in the last days in office, Susan?
And I think that Shelley has an important question, and there are a lot of people in the national security apparatus, in the military and other places that are concerned about what actions President Trump still might take. He still is the president. He still has authority to do different things. There were some speculation last night that the acting national security advisor was considering resigning as well. He has chosen not to, and some have speculated it's because he doesn't want to leave that position vacant for whatever it would be worth for him to remain. But I think a lot of people have a lot of concerns about what potentially could be done in the next week and a half or so until President-elect Biden is inaugurated.
Thanks for that call. We'll go now to Lindsay calling from Madison. Lindsay, hi.
Hi, yeah. I wanted to before we even made any decisions on whether the 20th Amendment should be revoked or anything like that, I'm wondering about the security piece of it, since that seemed to be so different than what we had seen in the summer. And this discussion wouldn't even be to this level if there wasn't actually a breach. And then that brings concerns then on, when you have such an emotional speech that was given by President Trump that day, Mike Pence called out by name, people were directed towards the Capitol, and then there was actually a breach, even though all of that seemed to be foreseen. What does that mean for inauguration? What does that mean for the safety of Mike Pence or President-elect Biden, Kamala Harris? If there is such a change in the security level that seems to have dumbfounded so many law enforcement officers that have been interviewed about it as well since then.
Lindsay, thanks a lot for the call. And Susan, I've seen some of the people on conservative social media sites who had instigated yesterday's events saying, yeah, we're going to come back for inauguration, but better armed. What kind of concerns do you share Lindsay's concerns?
I do. And the one thing that is being done immediately is a non-scalable fence is being built, put up around the Capitol. And so that's a visible deterrent. And long term, there are going to be people are going to lose their jobs insofar as the Capitol Police and their reaction or lack of reaction. I mean, there's images of at least one Capitol Police officer taking a selfie with one of the people who were, breaching security and walking through the Capitol. So there's going to be long-term issues that are going to be dealt with into the Biden administration for sure, and Congress will have to evaluate. And then we have short-term things like this fence, but then we also have the inauguration, which is coming up very quickly, and issues of safety and security. And my assumption is that the city of Washington, D.C. is going to be on lockdown, and it's going to remain on lockdown to whatever extent possible. And the security level at the inauguration, which because of COVID is going to be a very small affair, and I would say thankfully, the security level is going to be like probably nothing we've ever seen.
Thanks for that call. We're looking at the fallout from yesterday's pro-Trump mob at the U.S. Capitol with Susan Johnson, political scientist at UW-Whitewater. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions and your questions. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're looking at the events at the U.S. Capitol yesterday with Susan Johnson, associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater, taking your questions, thoughts, reactions at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Sam is with us in Wisconsin Rapids. Sam, hello.
Hi. So I was really disappointed with the riots yesterday and just how much damage was being done to the Capitol and also to, putting people's lives in danger like the police. But I was also equally disappointed, this summer when I feel like the Democratic Party was really either slow or just kind of openly fine with lots of rioting that went on for the whole duration of the summer that I really thought caused more damage and destruction and had more lives damaged as a result. And I was kind of confused why, if the Republican Party was, pretty open to condemning the riots, why, the Democratic Party kind of all throughout the year was more or less okay with riots all over the country.
Sam, thanks a lot for the call. Susan, some key Democrats, including then-candidate Biden, had condemned the riots along the way. But Sam's saying Democrats should have done more to speak up about those then. Could you compare and contrast for us?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people are using the issue of the riots this summer or the protests this summer to draw comparisons in regard to what happened yesterday. And I think it's difficult sometimes to draw comparisons because of the reasons behind why people are protesting, who's involved in different protests and things like that. But there certainly were Democrats this summer who were speaking out against the violence that accompanied some of the protests that took place.
Sam, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go to Sean now in Milwaukee. Sean, hi.
Hi there. I was just going to chime in a little bit about, we got to blame Trump. I mean, but we got to understand that narcissists and psychopaths are going to get into a position of power. Well, how do they get into a position of power? It's because they're for sure feeding misinformation, but the real deeper core problem is people obviously believing that misinformation. Well, why are they believing misinformation? Well, I'm guessing they probably get it from a very young age, and they're believing in things that aren't real from a very young age about how the world is, whether it be God, spirits, religion, blind faith, whatever. But of course, that's going to transition later into life with all this BS that we're doing right now. So anything else that we're talking about is swatting at flies because we don't get to the root of what are making these kids grow up and believe in nonsense. We're missing the whole point altogether. Now, that's a point more towards the Democrats, I think, and then our education system as well.
Sean, thanks for the call. Susan, Sean saying we need to get to the roots of why people believe misinformation in the first place.
Well, I mean, I think that I just had this conversation with a colleague, actually, is that we do have a lack of civic education in this country. And the idea that maybe if people had a better understanding of how government operates and what is and isn't happening or what is and isn't possible, that some of that misinformation would not, or there wouldn't be as much misinformation. But there's a lack, I would say, and I wish in our education system, both at the secondary and also in higher ed, that we did more to educate people about how government works and American history and things like that, because I think that's important.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater, looking at yesterday's events at the Capitol and looking forward to the future. Susan, before we run out of time, I want to talk to you today about what we thought was going to be our big political issue going into yesterday. The Georgia Senate races, Democrats swept them, I think, against many expectations, with the vice president a Democrat. After Inauguration Day, Democrats can have a majority in the Senate. Can you talk about what that means?
It means that the Democrats are going to have the majority and they can control the agenda. I think some notable things that it means is that Vice President Biden's cabinet secretaries will be confirmed in a much more quick manner, which I think most people will really want to see happen, particularly that because we're in the middle of a global pandemic and things like that. So the Biden administration will make it, it will be easier for them to get up and running. As far as the president's legislative agenda, there will be at least these issues will be debated in the Senate. They may not pass in the form that President-elect Biden would like to see, but at least there will be a debate on these issues. And then I think from the Democrats' perspective, they're very happy that they will be able to appoint judges to the federal bench, including should a Supreme Court vacancy come up.
Let's go back to our callers now. Mike is with us in Milwaukee. Mike, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I just wanted to bring up, too, I think as far as a lot of the misinformation and things that are out there, ever since the Fairness Doctrine has been dismantled. I believe it was in the late 80s. We've been seeing a more and more of a division in the country. Democracy is built off of non-bias factual news. And between the Fairness Doctrine getting dismantled and all of the ways social media and people are misusing social media to consume information, I think has brought us to this point where somebody like Trump is able to gain a foothold by, you know, taking advantage and using that system. And, you know,
gotcha, Mike. Thanks for calling in. Susan, Mike pointing in at one of the big questions of our time. What has led to the polarization and the, I guess, violent polarization in this country? Mike, changing to changes in the media and social media.
Well, I think that certainly has a role to play. And many people have done research on this, and they found that people tend to go to particular sources for their news, and we're a country that's divided in that regard. And I'm old enough to remember when there were the three major news networks in PBS, and that's where you got your news. And we all got the same news. And, you know, the newspapers were much more robust. And what we see now is that there's so many different options that people pick and choose what they want, and we're not all consuming the same information. And if you go and look and see how what happened yesterday is being covered on different, even if you just think about the different cable networks, you're going to find different things. And if we're only watching what we believe, that does not bode well, and it hasn't bode well.
Susan, some people have expressed hope that this shocking scene yesterday will moderate some people, will lead some people to want to work together, maybe even in the halls of Congress. In our last 30 seconds or so, do you think there's a chance of that?
I think if there was a great chance of that, we would have seen the debate end yesterday and not have the objections to the Electoral College vote continue. So I'm not as optimistic as some others.
Susan, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Happy to do it.
Susan Johnson is an associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. We talked with her about the latest politics in Washington, D.C., including calls to impeach or remove President Trump from office after yesterday's scene at the Capitol. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 8, Kate and her guests look at the rollout of COVID-19 vaccines in the United States and at the racial disparities in healthcare access, disease outcomes, and in figuring out who gets vaccinated first. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then lots of 20-somethings feel the pressure to make big career and life moves. We talked to a writer who says 2020 felt like a lost year for many young people. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.